Hello, hello, hello.
Hello. I think I pushed the right buttons.
Uh-huh. You can hear me and you're not going, oh no, what's going on? So
there's not two of you in my ears and there's not none of you in my ears. So there's just the right amount of you in my ears.
Let's not, I was going to say we could at any point branch off from that, but it is good to chit chat. Once again, and have all these festivities with the internets. Yep.
We're here, and oh, that's of all of the gifts you picked, that one.
Huh. Yeah. I was just scrolling through everything that said Blade Runner, and the one where Harrison Ford makes that weird smirk when he's at the noodle bar at the beginning. I was just like, you know what? Sure. Let's go for that one.
It's got chopsticks. I had some Chinese food today. I also used some chopsticks, so let's use that for reasoning as well.
Yeah, by the transitive property of chopsticks, you're Harrison Ford.
Okay. He doesn't like really embarrass himself in this movie that much, I guess. So I could.
No, he waited to do that later with airplanes, but yeah,
with airplanes.
Oh, he's had some rough landings.
You mean in real life? I thought you were talking about movies. I was was he in an airplane?
I mean, I don't know. I haven't seen the sequel to this movie yet, so maybe he goes on to have a extended aerial chase.
No. I mean, the flying cars are kind of like airplanes.
Yeah, the spinners, as they are referred to.
No, they're not called that.
Well, they're called that in the expanded universe outside of the film, but the film itself never refers to them at all.
That's good. You shouldn't. I guess they didn't have Urban Dictionary in 1982, so that's fine.
Well, okay. I mean, there's a lot of different meanings for words that you could use, so I wouldn't get too hung up on that one.
You wouldn't, would you?
No, I wouldn't get too hung up on spinners, is what I'm saying.
It's those rims people put on their cars in the early 2000s.
Yes, a very bad job with those rims, if you ask me.
I saw a car with those on them 2 weeks ago, and I was gobsmacked that they still existed. I think it was a Hummer, even too.
Yeah, well,
H2.
Like a month ago, I saw a DeLorean, like a real classic DeLorean, and I was just like, wow. 80s.
They didn't do the mod kit to put the Mr. Fusion on the back?
No, they didn't. It was just a real DeLorean.
I mean, why even bother at that point?
I don't know.
Unless it was Seth Worley. Sorry if that was Seth.
No, it wasn't. I saw the person getting out at the Shell gas station on Burbank and Sepulveda, and it was not Seth Worley. Yeah. But
it's a shame.
You know, maybe one of these days it can be. Depending
maybe
on how
one of the
plotdevices.co's launch of story clock
notebooks
goes.
Oh, they got so many cool
goes.
Stuff there. Have you looked at the website today? They got so much cool stuff there.
No, I was busy when it went out, and so I just like faved it, and I was going to circle back, but I didn't actually circle back, so I guess.
Yeah, there's story clocks, which I got mine over here still. I still haven't used it yet.
I got the story clocks from the Kickstarter originally, and the poster thing with the cat, I love it.
Mm-hmm.
Love that one.
It's a good poster.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's also storyboard notebooks now, which I really like, and I'll probably buy a bunch of. And then they've got enamel pins. I don't know if you saw the tweet with the enamel pin with the mini DV tape, because that's pretty dope.
I did not see that, but I know that you have an affection for mini DV.
Oh, God, it's so great. It's just like the perfect little Sony mini DV tape, the black with the little red stripe across the top is an enamel pin. Mm-hmm. There's two other enamel pins. I'm totally spacing on what they are right now. And then they've got sports pennants, like the old school kind, but they say like Spielberg on them and the Get Rich and Die Writing thing.
Yeah, I saw that one on the Twitter as part of the promotional thing. And I was like, oh, it's kind of bold to use Spielberg's name, but sure.
Yeah, the other pins are there's a skull wearing Anaglyph 3D glasses, and there are two hands, like severed hands with bones coming out, making little director's window with a little colored gradient in between the fingers. It's pretty cool looking, too.
Oh, that's nice. It's all a bunch of nice stuff.
There's some good stuff here. I like these storyboard notebooks, too, because they're black, which is cool.
Mm-hmm.
Very official looking.
Yeah, also, I should say that Seth is not paying us to say any of these nice things, so that's how you know that we're speaking the truth.
Seth, don't pay us. Mail us cool stuff, because this is cool.
Yes, yes. Persuade us to talk about this. No, but
well, I think we did this backwards.
Yeah, ugh, crud.
We said all the nice things first.
We can think of more nice things to say later once we get the free stuff.
No, but it's all the nice things there are to say.
We've exhausted the whole thing. Well, it doesn't say a lot of good things about our ability to use the Story Clock notebook or the Storyboard notebook if we can't think of more nice things to say. But aside from that, we have just been, you know, moving on in the world today with all of our creative juices flowing, because it's such a great place to live. And
this sounds like a segue. Is this a segue? I don't know where you're going with this.
It's a segue into the post-apocalypse.
We don't need to talk about my mail before we do that.
Oh, well, we can. I didn't want to go through your mail because it's a federal crime. So,
Well, you're not allowed to open it, but I think if I opened the conversation,
if you tweet a photo of it,
if I tweet a photo of it, that means it's a matter of public record, and then it can be discussed. So was this a film tie-in?
So there were a lot of things that percolated in my brain that led to this.
connect the synapses for us, Joe.
Yeah. So there's the Dubai Friday podcast, and they had done an Amazon challenge a while ago, and it was funny, lol. And then they were threatening to do it again with their Kickstarter thing. I'm sorry, Patreon thing. And if you're a Patreon person, you get to get a sort of glimpse behind the scenes of what the upcoming challenges are. And they had talked about going to do the Amazon stuff for the upcoming week. And so I was thinking, oh, I haven't sent Dan anything arduous in a while. Cause...
By arduous, you mean some form of Amazon product combined with some form of maple syrup.
Yes, exactly. Because two years ago, I sent you the fire tablet, the 7-inch uh-huh. fire tablet, and a bottle of Coombs Family organic maple syrup. And you didn't like that one very much, either of those, I should say.
I thought I liked maple syrup just fine. I think my complaint, if anything, was the complaint I had.
You said it wasn't as good as Aunt Jemima.
No, I said no such thing. I said they are different things and they are both equally good. But again, the reason I dislike the real maple syrup in the first place is because you have to refrigerate it, and because I don't like the cold syrup making my waffles or pancakes cold. And I'm too lazy to heat it up because I don't have like a small microwave safe like ramekin to pour maple syrup in, because it's weird.
Well, now I know what I'm getting you next time.
A small microwave bowl ramekin for maple syrup?
Yeah, those little Pyrex custard bowls or whatever.
Well, I have, now that I think about it, I have two tiny little ones from Crate and Barrel that were left over from a movie shoot, except I'm not sure they're microwavable.
Are they Pyrex glass kind of things?
No, they're ceramic of some form.
Probably.
It's possible.
Usually it is, but I suppose on the bottom, it'll probably say something. So refer to the bottom of your ramekin.
I will do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But no, these were always nice things. Did you send me the Fire Stick too, or did I buy that of my own?
Oh no, you bought that on your own.
Okay. I was trying to remember. It's like, are all of the Amazon products in my home because you sent them to me, or is it just 2/3 of them?
No. See, you had the crummy Apple TV 3rd generation, and you were getting really fed up with it.
What do you mean had? I still have it. It's still stupid.
Yeah, and you were really upset about rentals and things were going awry, and when Amazon came out with the 2nd generation Fire Stick, I had bought it, and then they had a big old fire sale, around Thanksgiving time, like Black Friday, Cyber Monday, whatever. And so it was like $10 off, and you asked me if you should buy it, and I said, yep, and you bought it. And then I think you bought it for your mom for Christmas after that, because you liked it so much.
Yes. It's a good device, with the exception of recently, I don't know, it's probably my internet connection or something, where I would yell something at it, and then it would get the text right, but then nothing would show up in the search results. Other than that, it's been a delight. And you just sent me the website thing, so I can make my dot control my stick now.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't even have to push the button on the remote anymore. I can just shout into the ether that I want to watch some early 80s sci-fi stuff, and then it'll show up.
Yeah. If there are multiple things to pick from, or there's no like free option that's available to you, then it does bring up a screen where you still have to pick something. So like, for instance, you
gotta use your hands like a baby's toy.
Yeah. If you say blankety blank, I would like to watch Matrix Revolutions, then it knows that I have a Netflix subscription and that it's free on Netflix, and it's going to play it, and it's not going to ask me any questions. However, if I want to watch, let's say, Blade Runner, Final Cut, and I say that, it's going to be like, hey, well, hold on, not free anywhere. So you got to pick something, and then you got to pick through the little menus. And the sale price of $6.99 to buy it and $3.99 to rent it yesterday changed to $3.99 to rent and $9.99 to buy. And I was like, oh, now you went from a purchase to a rental. I should have bought it yesterday. Yeah.
Yeah, it went from good, I can buy this, to I guess I'll buy this because it's important to people and I should probably own it. So I bought it on iTunes because I still have more Apple products than Amazon products, though the number is becoming more even these days now. So it's on my iTunes devices. Although I can watch Amazon movies on my my phone, can't I? Somehow?
Yeah. Amazon Video app?
I should figure out how to use that. It's very weird.
it's an app. The thing is, if you see something with a little green banner at the top that says Prime, that means that it's available to you to watch for free. If you tap on something, and it just brings up, like, how do I watch this? Then that means it's not free, and you have to go buy it on a website somewhere. Because... Mm-hmm. of Amazon and Apple's working relationship when it comes to purchasing things.
I'm scrolling. I'm tapping library. This would be where... Oh, look, there's a thing. I bought Dread. Remember, this is the one movie that I purchased on Amazon. That's still there.
Yep.
And you're saying if I tap on this, it'll play on my thing.
It does.
Oh, look at that. Oh, there's a... Is that a progress bar underneath the resume button, or is that just a button glitch? No, it looks like a progress bar, but it's the same color. So that's wonderfully designed. Anyway... Yeah. Mobile operating systems, those don't have any issues.
No, I seem to recall you had a tirade. Shall I assume you might not have been 100% sober when you were sending out your hot takes on mobile operating systems and key binding solutions?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, I've been thinking about these little things that have been nagging at me as I've been using iOS 11 for whatever, a couple of weeks now, and I've been thinking about trying to formulate that into a concise, rational opinion. But then I had had some alcohol last night, and then I said, you know what, I'm going to yell about this phone on Twitter until I'm out of things to say. And I even forgot something, but then by the time I remembered, like 15 minutes later, I was like, well, I can't do this again because people will think I'm a crazy person.
That would be silly. Like,
but I wanted to, because I was listening to the Mac Power Users with Merlin on, and I wanted to re-up his increased typos on the phone these days. I make so many typos. Like, it's so much worse than it used to be. Plus, like, I keep accidentally hitting, like, the autocomplete word at the top there somehow now, too. So it's, like, adding whole words in there, not just spelling things wrong. Like, it's the worst. Like, I can't write basic sentences unless I'm 100% concentrating, and it's not pleasant. Sorry. Are you seeing any increased typos on your writings?
Yes, I am. I assume that's because I have an iPhone 6 and it is super laggy. But I would think that just like text entry in a field in iMessage shouldn't really trigger as many lags as it seems to. I in part blame some of this on the iMessage apps. They seem to have put them in the way of my typing on purpose, so that people...
Well, you can make that go away, you know.
I know, but once you drag down on it and make it go away, and then you're like, oh, I need to send somebody a GIF, and then you like get the little images thing, and then you send somebody a thing, then it's like, nope, you want to see that app thing for the rest of your life. And you're like, no, I want to get to drag that back down again. Because for some reason, I keep opening it, and there's the bar, and it has a doodle on it. And so I go to try to type in the field above it, and it hits the doodle iMessage app, which is an app that Jason Snell uses for incomparable coordination for, like, setting up meeting times. Like, when is
that? The literal doodle one, not, like, the doodle as in, like, draw some text with your finger doodle.
No, not that. Yeah. but blah.
Mm.
Yeah. I just I don't care for it. And if you try to use Spotlight, it's like, hey, I'm going to just start scrolling through a bunch of things while you're typing things. And then if you go to try to tap on one of my recommendations, I'm going to finish what I was showing as a recommendation and put in a different thing because I'm just registering a key click you did 10 seconds ago. And then you tap on that thing you didn't mean to tap on. That's always fun, too. I like that one. And it's just yay. Woo.
Ecosystem. So, you know, it's good that we're putting more and more stock in artificial intelligence and things like that. So now I have one listening to me constantly.
Yes, well, that's what makes it.
I brought it in here. I put it next to me too. I didn't know if you wanted to like do anything fun live on the air.
Oh no, Dan, that's not a thing people do on podcasts because that just leads to disaster. I
bought some poop bags for a dog by yelling at a puck.
I'm surprised that you did that.
Why wouldn't I do that?
I don't know. I figured you've had it for like less than 12 hours. I still haven't bought anything by using my voice.
You've never purchased anything with it?
No, of course not. That's what they want you to do. That's how they get you.
It's a reorder thing, so it's like it knows, but it already knows I have that.
Yeah, no, I don't need to. I don't order poop bags. As hard as that might be to believe. But
well, where do you do your business when you're on the street? Also, I already connected my Google and iCloud calendars to it, so I can just yell at it and ask like where I'm supposed to be and when I'm supposed to be there.
Wow,
it's probably a terrible idea for a home device, but this is what I'm doing.
You did a lot of stuff. You also sent me like two voice memos that I haven't listened to yet. So
yeah, well, one of them was a voice memo and the other one was a text memo saying how embarrassing is it that it both translates the voice memo to text for you wrongly, and then it lets you listen to the voice memo, which is like super awkward because it's like me in my echoey kitchen yelling at you.
Yeah, I don't know. I haven't listened to them yet, but ta-da. And make sure you plug it into speakers though. So
yeah, I haven't yet acquired any speakers for it, but it's very loud without speakers on its own.
Yeah, I just don't care for it. Like it just doesn't sound fulsome, I should say, I guess, maybe.
Fulsome?
Voluminous. Doesn't fill the room.
Mm.
You know?
Well, that's cool, and thank you.
Yeah. Well, no problem. Just don't get the syrup on it. But speaking of echoes and whether or not they dream of electronic doggy bag orders, let's talk about all the fun stuff that we have to talk about with the movie.
Mm-hmm. Blade Runner. 1982, Ridley Scott. It's a very, very famous, very important movie, apparently.
You said that in such an unconvincing way.
You know, I have a complicated opinion of this movie because I'm attempting to put it in context with all of the other things from the early 80s and all of the other sci-fi movies and all of the other Ridley Scott stuff. And this is very much, you know, this is very much like the original Alien in terms of like quiet, somber, slow, very kind of atmospheric movie. And those parts of the movie are amazing. And the cinematography of this movie is fantastic and it's gorgeous. And it's very interesting to think about and to look at and explore the world in your mind. But then as a movie, it's just, I don't want to be like mean and be like this movie is dumb or whatever, but like, it's just, there's the plot wise is just kind of, I don't like it. I'm sorry.
It's understandable. I kind of, I love the visuals of this movie. I love the revival of this sort of film noir style, not just in the visuals, but you know, they certainly invoke it in how they stage these scenes and even do directing notes and all that crap.
A lot of saxophone too, that works with the noir.
So much saxophone. So you get a really different feeling from the film than you do from let's just say like any other science fiction future thing that was before this movie. Now, if you had not seen this movie before you watched a bunch of other things that came after it, then you might be like, oh, this looks very similar. Well, that's because everybody else ripped this thing off for what it looks like. And so, like, remember when we talked about the first Judge Dredd movie, the one with Sylvester Stallone?
Mm-hmm.
And they just, like, ripped it off wholesale for the city streets and the design of the neon windows and stuff like that, and the bazaar that they go to. Like, basically, like, all of this stuff kind of came from this as sort of a progenitor. And there's lots of other movies that pull from this and look to this for inspiration. So it is certainly an influential film. It was not a financial success when it came out. Harrison Ford doesn't even really like this movie that much.
I can understand why he doesn't like it, because his character doesn't really get to do much other than... I mean, there's very little depth to the characters. When I say, like, I don't like the movie, I mean, I'm talking about plot-wise and character-wise. The things that the characters have to do is pretty... It's pretty simple on its face. Like, he is a retired cop who had to do some bad things that he was not super into, and now he's got a drinking problem, and they pull him back in, and, oh, he's struggling to deal with it, and he's drinking more, but also maybe there's a chance that he can live a good life and have some love, even if it's in a weird way. But, like, it's not explored in a deep manner or really with much nuance, so it's just kind of there. So it feels like he didn't really get to do much, and I can't imagine he would enjoy watching this performance.
No. He also objected to the voiceover, which is not in the version that you and I watched, but was in the original.
We should stipulate up front. We watched the final cut with no voiceover, which I don't... You know how, like, all of the other movies that came after this, which reference it, kind of spoil part of the original? In that same way, like, having seen the voiceover version of this movie has kind of spoiled some of the movie for me. Like, you know, when what's-his-name comes up to him at the noodle bar and he's speaking in weird language and he, like, gets the bartender guy or whatever to go, like, what is this guy saying to me? Like, there's voiceover in there that's talking about the guy is using some sort of weird local garbage dialect or something or other that I don't understand, or there's something like that.
City speak, right?
Whatever the hell it was, but, like, why is that in my head when I'm watching this? Like, I wish I didn't even know that. I didn't have that information, and it's just, like... All of the voiceover is bad, although there are a couple instances where I'm watching this and I'm like, this is conspicuously silent right here. Like when they're flying around in the car and he's talking to the garbage language guy, and then it's just, we're outside the car, so we don't hear anything. So it's like, this is peculiar, but that's fine, I guess. It was just like one major scene.
Yeah, I'm going to share a little secret. I don't think I've ever seen the version that has voiceover.
Oh, it's on TV all the time. It's the only one they run on TV.
I feel like I've only ever seen the versions without, or if I have seen the voiceover versions, I watched parts that didn't have it. because what was it? The theatrical cut came out in, like, what, 97 or something like that? I don't remember. The late 90s, basically. And the theatrical cut wasn't completely overseen by Ridley Scott, but it did do away with the voiceover. And then the final cut is the one that Ridley Scott oversaw. And that was early 2000s, I want to say, maybe, or mid 2000s. And so that also doesn't have the voiceover, and that is the one we watched. And to be perfectly honest, I probably would fail at any sort of quizzing about which version you were watching or testing along those lines.
Visually, is there really that much of a difference in terms of what's in the movie and what's not? Because I know I've seen, like, all of this before, but I feel like the only major difference is the voiceover.
I don't think there's a major difference in, like, the runtime of the films, because I think they're all about 117 minutes, or thereabouts. Like, it's not like they added entire things that change everything, you know? It's not like James Cameron's other cut of Terminator 2 that added, like, 20 minutes, you know? it's also not like Ridley Scott's director's cut that he did for Alien, when Fox was going back through and they were like, oh, DVD sales are great. Let's make a director's cut. And so he added in something that had been excised from the original, which was that scene of Sigourney Weaver coming across all of the cocoon encrusted metamorphing crew members that had been taken away by the aliens. And right. that, of course, is contradicted by all of the other stuff that we see in the sequels, because they never had to deal with any of that. But Ridley Scott's like, yeah, sure, throw it in. And so it's in. That's one of the reasons why I strongly object to watching the director's cut of that film, because it just felt like so superfluous and after the thought. For Blade Runner, I do agree that removing the voiceover seems to be a good idea. I think I saw like a clip one time of Harrison Ford's dispassionate reading of some of the dialogue.
It's the worst. Yeah. It's like the most lackluster dialogue ever. But real time follow up, Mr. Jay Ziegler in our chat reminded us that the ending is different. There's like that footage, like after he closes the elevator door, like there's some like aerial footage of them like driving the Volkswagen through the woods. Remember the leftover Shining footage that he borrowed?
Yeah, Stanley Kubrick footage. He just went to his buddy. It's like, hey, need a happy ending. So there you go.
And then, according to him, also the weird dream he has about the unicorn running around in the forest is also not in. That makes sense, because I don't remember seeing that before. That was peculiar.
Well, the one thing that makes me always laugh about the unicorn thing is just its floppy unicorn horn, because. You know, the technology available to them.
You know, maybe his HMO didn't cover unicorn horn stiffener.
Oh. Yeah, no, I like this movie enough in this format that I don't really need to go seek out reasons to find a better cut of this.
The problem is the visuals are so beautiful and so cool to look at and so wonderful that it borders on the kind of thing that people do on Vimeo these days, where they create this really cool like 3-minute short film that's awesome to look at, but then when it's over you're like, what was that?
Yeah, but that is one of the charming aspects of it, though, is that you have all this visual material to dwell in for an extended period of time. It's not just a 3-minute short. The downside, like you're saying, is just, well, the story, it's not great. And if you are if you were hoping to be swept away by the storyline of a Ridley Scott movie, I have some bad news for you. I don't think, to my knowledge, he's ever really prioritized the role of the written word in the productions that he has put on. It just seems to be more of a coincidence when that works out.
I didn't find the dialogue particularly offensive in this. It's just in terms of like what actually occurs in this movie it's all very interesting, and there's a small thread of the thought provoking, and you know, what does it mean to be human, and the replicants as slaves and that sort of stuff, but none of it's really explored very much. You're just sort of like along for the ride watching, which works if it's a slightly more personal story, if you're riding along with a character that you care about. But we're bouncing back and forth between, like, I think I feel more for Rutger Hauer than I do for Harrison Ford in this movie, or anyone else really. Like, he's the only one who's trying to do something and then is thwarted, and then, like, you know, is sad and dies. But like, you know, Harrison Ford kind of sort of breaks out of who he was for like 5 seconds at the end to go off and have another life, even though he kind of ruined Sean Young's life, and then they're gonna go see how that works out somewhere together. But like, I don't care about either of them, other than the fact that like Sean Young's like wardrobe and hair is like amazing.
Yeah, no, there's really no arguing with that. So yeah, I don't know. I don't feel anything. Even for Roy, I enjoy Rutger Hauer's performance as Roy, but Roy
he manages
himself
to make a murderer psychopath feel a little bit, you know, you feel a little sad for him because he wants more life and he can't have it.
I don't feel sad for him because he murders people. So I don't feel like that's a good message I want to reinforce in the world, is that I feel sad for him. But I do. but I do. Like his quirks that he offers in this performance, and my understanding is a substantial amount of things that he just sort of improv'd, just doing and saying whatever would sound interesting. Like, I think something about the whole, like, sea beams glittering off the, you know, that whole thing, I think it was just a bunch of made up stuff, was my understanding of it. But, yeah, he brings a lot of material to this and a physicality to Roy. Unfortunately, he has the worst wardrobe out of everybody. I don't know if you noticed when he walks into the room and he doesn't have that big long overcoat on. He just has his slacks and his shirt. His slacks come like basically almost up entirely to his nipples. Like they're like beyond old man golf pants. it's just absurd. I don't understand the placement of the pant line there, but he's interesting. I will certainly say of all of the replicants, if I had to rank them as in my interest level in them, it would be Roy, Leon, then Zora, and then Pris. And I don't even like Zora. I just dislike Pris more than I dislike Zora. Pris is. She does virtually nothing, and it's just a lot of screaming. Zora doesn't scream as much, so that's why.
Well, Pris is a what do they call her? A leisure replicant of some sort.
This is a casual way of saying that she is basically a sex slave.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Or some form of entertainment. Maybe she plays instruments. I mean, clearly maybe she can do sort of like a Zumanity type thing. She can clearly dress up in funky stuff and dance around like Vegas show stuff.
She missed her calling to start her own Cirque du Soleil
That's
performance.
That's the one I was thinking of. Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, too bad. Yeah. She was briefly in this and spray paints her face with mm-hmm. the airbrush thing. So I don't know. I don't love her because she's not a character. At all. She just does a series of actions in the span of this film. Mm-hmm.
Used as a plot device to try and connect the replicants to Mr. J.F. Sebastian to get to Mr. Tyrell, who we got from the eyeball maker in the freezer.
Yeah, and then in her final scene, she's just like flash dance murdering somebody. Like, it's not great. I don't understand why we should care about her. Zora, I also don't get, because like they're supposed to be trying to break into the Tyrell Corporation, but somehow she has a job that involves a fake snake that she's at this bar and does dance stuff for.
They're trying to get jobs to blend in so they can be down on Earth, and then while they're there try and figure out how to find whoever has the knowledge to fix them and let them live beyond 4 years.
Yeah, so she's like definitely the money source out of this group, because none of them seem to be working. Leon has a very brief job when he works for Tyrell Corporation before he's found at the beginning.
It's a very weird scene in the beginning there. Like the conversational tone back and forth, it's disjointed and off-putting, which I guess is kind of the point, but like the tone they're going for in that scene is so peculiar, and I guess it's sort of to try and like make you uncomfortable and make you realize that this is a different world than the one you live in. But I find it very odd the way Leon reacts to Holden.
Yeah, well, it's supposed to be odd though, and it's supposed to be uncomfortable. The questions are weird, and as an audience member, you have no context for them, so it throws you off. You don't know why this is really occurring. You kind of find all this stuff out later, afterwards. But this scene serves to sort of throw you off your balance in terms of who should you really be like thinking about in this world, and like where do people fit in, because there's just this guy who's interviewing this other guy, and then he asks him a question about turtles and he doesn't know what a turtle is, and there's just more tension and tension and cigarette smoking for some reason, and then there's the gunfire that knocks him through a wall, which is kind of crazy. Yeah. You start to piece together that this is maybe one of those replicants, and he was doing a test about this replicant.
Of course, we got the opening crawl in the beginning that says the replicants were created to be off-world slaves to do all the dirty work the humans don't want to do. But then, what, some of them escaped and they killed some people, so they were then outlawed on Earth. So they were not allowed on Earth. They were only allowed off-world, theoretically. But if they come back down to Earth, then they got to be killed by Blade Runners. I don't know why they're called Blade Runners, but whatever, right? That's basically it.
And when you kill them, it's called retirement. And
yeah, that's...
That never comes into play at any point in the movie.
The term is used one time by Sean Young, but like we would have been able to put that together with context clues, so we didn't need that. But
you never retire a human by accident.
Yes, I have some plotting questions. So like, I know I'm totally missing the point of this movie, but I want to talk about the plot down to the nitty gritty details to see if I understand what actually occurred in this movie. So. Six replicants escaped from wherever, made their way down to Earth. Two of them died in some sort of electrical,
They got fried by the security system when they tried to break into Tyrell Corporation.
Four of them made it down. That's Leon, Roy, Pris, and Zora. And then they're tracking them down. So Leon got a job at the Tyrell Corporation because like that's where they landed, I think, and then he's trying to blend in there while they kill time and try to figure out where they're going. But
they're trying to get inside the Tyrell Corporation because that's also where they tried to break into.
Okay, so here's my confusion. He got a job at the Tyrell Corporation because presumably they know that's where they were made, and those are the people who would have the information about how to extend their lives. But then why do they go to Eyeball Maker and threaten him / kill him to try and find somebody who can fix them, who then ultimately just ends up taking them back to the head of the Tyrell Corporation? Did they think like ultimately we may have to go to Mr. Tyrell, but hopefully we can find a lower peon who has the knowledge we're looking for? Like was that the plan?
No, I think it was the reverse of that. They wanted to go right to the source. But they could not really do that because they had the failed security problem, and then they had tried the infiltration, and that had also failed. So they knew that those avenues were closed to them. So then they tried to pursue other means. People who did work for the Tyrell Corporation who were not safely ensconced inside
of because he was already working there, but then he got discovered as a matter of course through his little test there, so he couldn't just like stroll back in on Monday morning and be like, hey guys, clocking in.
They have a video recording of
where's Dr. Tyrell, I need to have a conversation with him. So, but I don't know, I guess like there's three other of them, they couldn't have tried like one of the other ones to sneak in there or something.
Except they know that that had been tried, so I'm sure they're VoightConf screening everybody else who's applying to work at the office.
I guess. And not that I needed a lot of explanation, but like we never see the company, we never really see like how close in physical proximity or in like just actual logistic connection there is between wherever Leon was and wherever Dr. Tyrell was. Like it looks like they're like basically in the same building, but Leon was just working on like a lower floor. So like is it literally just they needed somebody to socially engineer Dr. Tyrell to like let the elevator come up to his floor, and that's it? Like this was the plan all along?
Well, I don't necessarily know the plan was to get inside of Tyrell's suite from the get-go, but they knew that their answers were inside the Tyrell Corporation or the people affiliated with it. So I think Leon might have been there either to get the rest of them in and to like raid the archives or whatever, or to get them to Tyrell. Eventually, at some point. It's just
a
guess.
I guess the eyeball guy is like an independent contractor who gets a lot of outsourced eyeball work from the Tyrell Corporation, because he doesn't actually work at the office, clearly, because they just kind of stroll in off the street. Mm-hmm. And then I guess J.F. Sebastian works there because he just comes home to his weird building on his own.
Yeah. So they don't show them they don't show those two people interacting with the Tyrell Corporation. They say what they did for the Tyrell Corporation. So in the case of the guy who designed the eyes, we don't know necessarily if that's like a past tense thing, like he no longer does that. But seemingly he has no connection to get them into the building because Roy is asking for that kind of a connection. And that's when he refers them to J.F. Sebastian. Because he knows that J.F. Sebastian does have that connection. So he might have been formerly employed, would be my guess, my assumption. As for JF Sebastian, he seems to at least be on friendly enough terms that he can be invited up to play chess with Tyrell. So I'm assuming he works there, like in some sort of context. Maybe he works out of the office on a couple days out of the week or something, but he says that he does genetic work for Tyrell. He does have his quirky, weird apartment off-site, that's for sure. But that doesn't mean that that doesn't discount that he could work for the Tyrell Corporation during some other hour. We don't see him inside of the apartment because we basically only see him with Pris, and then they go to the building.
I wonder if there was ever a plan to show sort of the inner workings of the Tyrell Corporation, because that would have been a very interesting production design thing to tackle, but probably very expensive. But at the same time, the fact that we didn't see that kind of leads me to this weird question about, like, all right, we're in this post-apocalyptic looking dystopian kind of thing. Like, is the Tyrell Corporation, like, still running at full speed and manufacturing as many replicants as they can? Or is production shut down now because a couple of their products killed some people? So it's kind of like, he went into hiding and, you know, they're just letting their products run their course. It's hard to tell if the company is really, like, an active business or just sort of sustaining itself or just kind of like hanging out until government regulation lets them go again or something.
We don't really need to know the finances of the Tyrell Corporation, but it doesn't seem...
Well, I guess not the finances, but like, are they actively making replicants still? Or is it just like, well, there's only so many left in the world/universe, and when they're gone, they're gone.
No, we at no point get anything about that would lead me to believe that they have any sort of restricted production of them. It's a restriction on whether or not they can be on Earth. It's not clear to me in the way the movie depicts things, because Rachel, of course, is a replicant, whether or not there is some sort of a test license that they can have for that. Also, we don't know if they manufacture replicants on Earth and then just ship them up and turn them on in space, or if there's like a staging area where that's permitted or something, but it seems like all of those things would be hazards. And yet, we have Rachel just walking around the office, walking out in the real world. So, you know, it's not... how should I put this? They're working and doing R&D, and they seem to have some capacity to be able to do that. Whether or not that work was legal, I have no idea. Mm-hmm. Because Deckard seems pretty remorseful when he discovers that Rachel is real and that she doesn't... Rachel's a replicant, and she doesn't know that she's a replicant. And he knows that she will need to be retired because she can't be on Earth. But it's odd that he doesn't act on that, and there's some sort of tension about whether or not they will need to act on these things. Like when the police chief talks to him after Zora is shot in the street, and the police chief is talking about how Rachel left the Tyrell Corporation. Mm-hmm. So they don't need to worry about tracking her down. That was weird, because it seems like that's part of his job, I guess.
Right. But, well, it's weird because Dr. Tyrell wanted to, like, you know, he said, like, let's run the test on a human to see if it's to get your baseline or whatever. And then it turns out he discovers that Rachel's a replicant. She doesn't know, because maybe she's like the next version of replicant because she's been programmed with a bunch of memories. But like, did what's his name, the police captain guy, just like, did he get the recording of the session like uploaded to his iCloud, or like, how did he know that? Did Harrison Ford report that? Because it didn't look like he reported it, or if he was in the mood to report it, because he very quickly falls in love with her and wants to just like hang out with her and stuff.
Yeah, there are no facts and evidence either way. It could have been something off screen that we'll never know about.
Yeah, the other thing I missed was when she comes over and tries to do her like, no, I'm really a real person because look at this photo of me and my mom. He starts rattling off like all of her memories that she never told anyone. Like, where did he get that? Like, presumably from a file or something, because even later in the movie we find out that, you know, like the learning piano thing, it's Tyrell's niece or daughter or something? That's where the memories came from?
Yeah, the niece.
How did we know that... First of all, how did we know it was the niece? And how did he did he just find like the manifesto, like the giant list of all of the memories that were implanted? Did Dr. Terrell just like volunteer that up after he found her out? Like, what?
It's not clear from the way the movie depicts it, but my assumption is that in that scene where he's, you know, oh, how many questions did it take you? Oh, doesn't, you know, isn't what a remarkable blah, blah, blah. You know, she's suspecting. And then I feel like that scene goes on further than that. We just don't see it as the audience, and that there is a delivery of things about her. There is also a moment where Rachel is asking Harrison Ford if he has seen like how long she has to live, and when she was basically, you know, built on this earth. And he's claiming that he didn't see the file.
Right, because they're classified, and he's drunk and falling asleep, and then... Mm-hmm. She starts to cry a little, and she's like, yeah, why don't you take the test, see if you're a human or not, and
yeah,
something. And it's like, where did that come from? That doesn't... Because I know, again, just, you know, this movie being what it is and being the cult classic that it is, like, just in the ether, there is debate over whether or not Deckard is a replicant. But that one line is the only thing that would lead us to believe that. Like, nothing, none of his other actions would lead us to believe that he is a replicant. So, there's, like, why is that line there? It doesn't help us, doesn't do anything for us, except for to say, like, are you, like, why are you superior to me, even if you're a human?
Well, but I think this is one of the things that the movie does not communicate very well, is that, Deckard has his opinions about this secondary form, this machine challenged, like this, whether or not this machine can be alive, or whether or not it is always just a machine. And when he has those things challenged and he feels empathy for those things, and also starts to question his own reality, like whether or not he could possibly be one of these things that he's going after. Like that those are the things the movie sort of, depending on the degree to which you are reading into what is being shown, not explained, then you might interpret some things. Like at the end, the origami unicorn.
Yeah. So
yeah.
Does the origami unicorn mean that his dream is programmed from somebody else and the other garbage speaker origami guy knows that his dreams are based on unicorns, so he leaves it there for him? Like, or is that coincident?
Well, that is something that was left ambiguous.
Ambiguous. It's stupid. Like, it's you need to leave some sort of breadcrumb trail for us to connect some dots, well, rather than vague correlation.
There is a breadcrumb trail because, like you had mentioned, when she goes to talk to Harrison Ford the first time, and he knows everything about her, things that she has never told anybody. And then we keep seeing that dream of his referenced, and we also see Graf making his origami things all the time. Then we get to that end moment when he's looking at the origami, and we hear Gas repeated over again, Edward James Olmos going, you know, she won't live, but then again, who does? And we start to, you can start to piece together whether or not that means that he is also a replicant who doesn't know that he's a replicant, is.
That line to me, it's a shame she won't live, but then again, who does? Just means that she's going to die someday. We're all going to die someday. So what does it matter if you're a replicant or a human being? Just live your life and do the best you can while you're here. Like, I took that as like, you know, I know you're protecting her because you're into her for whatever your reason may be. That's fine. She's not going to live. But if you want to spend some time with her, do that while you have the ability, because in the end, we're all dead. Like, I didn't take that as like, I know you're a replicant too. It was just sort of like a broader sort of philosophical nonsense.
Yeah, but that's what I mean by it's ambiguous, because at the end of Inception when the top keeps spinning and then it cuts away when it wobbles?
This is worse than that. I mean, yes, there are ambiguous things about this movie, but as people listening to this can probably tell, we have to make like 7 jumps in our own headcanon before we can even come to the theory that may or may not be true. So it's, I feel like they just threw a bunch of stuff against the wall, and it's like, you know, they're like, there you go. And you're like, what is it? And you're like, it's all of those things. I'm like,
see, I don't feel that way about it. I don't think that they've done an effective job at even communicating that ambiguity, because I feel like it is all too easy to miss any one of these hints that have been laid down and then be totally confused about what is happening at the end of it, and where it leaves these characters, and basically why you watched this. Like, what are we supposed to be getting out of Deckard's journey through this picture?
Yeah, and
is it that he regrets killing these things in general, or is it that he starts to understand that they're not really things, that they're also people, and that he is participating in a broken system? Does he only feel empathy for Rachel? Is he only scared now that he thinks he himself might be in some way affected in a manner that is similar to Rachel, that he might also be a replicant that doesn't know he's a replicant? These are you know, questions, and if you are, you know, it just can be very difficult to follow along the way things are put together, because a lot of this is also visual. Like there isn't a lot of text on the page or it's spoken here, where people explain things very thoroughly. Now that is, I feel, in general, a good thing, because nothing's worse than, as you know, Bob, replicants are terrible. And as you know, Bob, replicants can't be on Earth. Like that kind of stuff is just like lazy and sloppy, because of course they would know that. So why is the other character telling them that? But there is sort of the other side of things where it's just like, so I saw this image of a foil unicorn, and we've been seeing editing cuts of a unicorn, and we had this other scene from earlier, so what am I supposed to do with all of this info? And, you know, so that's it could be more effectively communicated if you were trying to reach a broader audience with your ideas.
Yeah, the only thing with the unicorn thing that I would be willing to grant them is that, and again, listen to all of the loops I got to jump through in my head to make this even make a lick of sense, is that the only way that Origami Guy would have known the unicorn thing was like implanted in his head, if Deckard was in fact a replicant, is if Deckard is a replicant built specifically to kill replicants, because they needed to, you know, you need to make one, you know, takes one to know one or to find him or whatever. Mm-hmm. Like, he's the best of the best to track him down and kill him. But, like, there's not enough of that there for me to give them. And then also care about, like, his psyche. Because if he was, in fact, just a human cop who spent, what, any number of years of his career tracking down things that walk, talked, and act like human beings and just, like, you know, executed them in the street because that's what the law said he had to do, sure, he would have the shakes and he would have, like, some personality disorders and he would not be super thrilled with his day-to-day life and he would probably have a drinking problem. Whether it is a human or a replicant, it's completely irrelevant because he has a personality and these are the things that are affecting him. That is the story that the movie is telling most of the time. And then this sort of like, oh, by the way, there's like this one scene where, oh, he, you know, you can't tell if he really was the best of the best of the Blade Runners or if the chief of police is just blowing smoke up his ass because all of the other good ones are dead and he's retired. He's got to come out of retirement for this. Like, why is he even retired if he's a replicant too? Because, like, wouldn't he be dead by now? Or just, like, you don't just, like, let somebody retire if you know they're going to die. It's like, oh, you can enjoy the last 6 months of your life because you did a good job. You know, you're going to let him work and assume that he's a human being and then he drops dead on his own. But that trying to connect the unicorn dream to the unicorn origami is the only thing that makes me say, okay, he was a replicant built specifically for killing other replicants, but there is nothing in this movie that supports that. So it's stupid and it's making me angry talking about it.
Okay, well, I just disagree that you should be this angry, but...
It's not that I'm angry, it's just that, like...
You just said you were angry.
Yeah,
you literally used the word, I'm angry.
I am angry at the fact that I'm coming up with things that I think this movie could and or should have done that it didn't even come close to doing. Because it is such a beautiful, rich world, and it is 2 hours long, and it's this slow, gorgeous-looking noir, and maybe they would have had to compromise some of their pacing in order to actually put some plot in there, but maybe they should have considered that, especially if there's three versions of it. Like, make a three-hour version of this movie. I'll watch it if it explains what the hell's going on.
Well, I'm not even sure they have that material, but...
Yeah, probably not.
It doesn't bother me as much, but I am... I don't know. Used to contemplative weird sci-fi things that don't necessarily have satisfying resolutions.
Right, but it's not contemplative because it wants you to think about stuff. It's contemplative because it didn't put enough stuff on the screen for us to understand what they were trying to say.
Yeah.
Did when they made this movie, not now, because Lord, don't ask them now. I'm sure most of this is in the sequel. Like, when they made this movie, did they have answers to these questions? Did they have an intent for all of these little pieces?
I don't know. There is a thing where this is based on a short story by Philip K. Dick called Do Androids Dream of Electronic Sheep? And it is substantially different from the film. However... Philip K. Dick saw the effects, a reel of the effects work that Trumbull had done before he passed away. And he thought that it was exactly what he had pictured. So, again, he thinks the visuals were great, and he didn't like particularly the first draft of it that he had read, and thought the People's draft, the one by People's, was fine. And that's the one that supposedly went into filming. But none of it's really based on exactly what he had written down. And even if you were to look at some of the other Philip K. Dick stuff that he's done, a lot of it is about, like, oh, well, what is even real? Like, basically, that could sum up any Philip K. Dick book. So I don't really think necessarily it is a fault of the filmmakers themselves if your biggest obstacle might be, like, what is reality? Because... Mm. Philip K. Dick kind of just sets up, like, what is even real as an obstacle in every Philip K. Dick thing.
See, yeah, but then, like, if I want to go broad world, what is even real, and I want to throw a wrench into my own theory earlier about him being a replicant made to kill other replicants, maybe literally everyone still on Earth is a replicant, and the reason Origami Guy knows about the unicorn dream is because he has the same dream. Like, maybe they're both... He's saying, like, hey, you and me, we're both replicants, so, like, you know, nothing matters because everyone on Earth is a replicant, we just don't know it anymore. That's an equally plausible, stupid thing, because there's nothing to tell us either way in this movie.
Well, no, but there's nothing to plant the seed of that either.
Well, he knows about the unicorn, and how does he know about it? We don't know, so...
But I feel like you're just...
I'm coming up with any theory that could connect Origami Unicorn Guy to Harrison Ford. Like, there are many different options.
I don't see as many, to be perfectly honest. But, you know, I can understand your frustration with this and the way that it's done. But yeah, I don't have a satisfying answer for you, and I'm not sure there is one that will satisfy you. So yeah, it's a good thing you own it forever.
Yeah,
exactly.
No, I mean it's worth it for the visuals alone. But, like, you know, it struggles from the fact that there are three-ish main characters in the movie, and I don't really know who I'm should be following or who I should care about, ostensibly. Harrison Ford is the main character, but I feel like he has less of an arc than Roy does, so I don't know. Like, being on his side feels kind of empty at the end of the movie. But, you know, it's just... I don't care about what happens in the movie in as much as I like looking at and thinking about the world, which is fine for fan fiction slash The Matrix 2 and 3, but it's not like that's not a satisfying movie experience.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. Cuz I still kind of like watching it. Even the boring parts.
Mhm. I mean, it's fun to look at. I do kind of tune out at parts because, like, in its stoicism and its noir, it does sort of neglect to make the audience care about what's actually happening. Like, there's a lot of quietness.
I feel a lot of that is, like you had mentioned several times, the disservice that is done to Harrison Ford's character, in that he basically just says a lot of like stoic stuff and then, you know, like stiff upper lip and just yeah, goes he's, on
he's,
with
he's
things.
He's got a storied past and he's an alcoholic, and anytime anyone asks him anything, he says, "I don't want to talk about it." And then he doesn't talk about it for an hour or so, and then it's over.
Yeah. So we don't necessarily get a fully realized picture of him. He has a very modest arc in terms of going from thinking that all of these replicants need to go because that's his job and he's just doing his job, to somebody who questions whether or not he should be doing that. But like I said, that's technically modest because we also don't know if he's we don't know, like, well, I don't want to get back into the morass of our previous discussion, but we don't know some things. So, you know, there's more that could be done in that area, in that space. I think Rachel is interesting in that she doesn't know what she is. And Sean Young, despite some wackiness later on in her life outside of this film, she does a good job with this role that she is given here, and she embodies this both in her physical performance as Rachel and I think emotionally, because she is also somewhat stoic and aloof and icy, shall I say, at the beginning of this, but she sort of softens as she starts to realize that things might not be what she had assumed that they were, that she doesn't have the certainty that she once had. And so she feels a little unmoored. And I think that makes her character a little interesting. I don't necessarily know they did everything they could with her. And there are certainly things about what the character does in terms of actions in the film that don't necessarily make a ton of sense. Like when she just happens to chase down Leon and shoot him. There, it's like, where did you come from, Sean Young? That was strange. Where'd you get that gun?
Well, she was across the street, and Deckard went to go chase her, and then got sidetracked by Leon. So she was still kind of in the vicinity, and that was Deckard's gun that got slapped out of his hand.
Yeah, but then she like circles back, gets the gun, shoots Leon without killing Harrison Ford. It was just like, okay.
Mm-hmm.
But like I said, that's not a big thing, but, it is what it is. I certainly like her more than I like Pris or Zora. I think that those aren't really even characters. They're just women figures that do women figure things and, some physical action.
Yeah, if this movie was an episode of Law and Order SVU, like, they would be like UPS delivery person one, like, they wouldn't have a character name. They'd be that character goes like, yeah, I saw him, he talked to the guy down there on the corner, he made a funny face and he ran off and got in his car, and then like that would be the next person they go talk to as the police. Like,
oh, speaking of the funny New Yorker accent you just did, what is up with the New York mob boss in LA that is at that bar?
The one that he like tries to question, then the guy buys him a drink, and he's like, "Well, I guess we're done talking now."
Yeah, that guy.
I don't know.
it's just a curious affectation. It was like, so What? Why is this New York mob boss here? From in not just like New York mob boss, like current era or in the 80s. I mean, New York mob boss, like circa 1930, is all of a sudden in your future movie.
You know, everything is old is new again or whatever. But I'm trying to even remember how we came to meet him, because he was asking that guy about the enhanced photo where he saw Zora in the reflection, because she's got the face tattoo of the snake in the photo that he stole from Leon's place, which took me a while to figure out that that wasn't also a photo left by Rachel. That was from Leon's place, which we got in dialogue because Leon went back to get his photos, but there were cops there, which he should have just killed him because he's stronger than all of them, but whatever, he just ran away instead. But no, who was this guy and why did he know what was in the photo? Or is he just like asking the owner of that bar, like, hey, do you happen to know this person? Does she work here?
I think he missed some connective tissue. There was also the scale that he had found.
Right, he found the scale and then he went and talked to the snake guy, and the snake guy like,
well,
pointed or something.
First, he went to the lady.
Right, the lady who said, this isn't a human or whatever.
This isn't a fish.
It isn't
it's a
fish, right.
It's a snake. And she told him the stall that he needed to go to go talk to the guy who made the snake, because there was a serial number on the scale at a microscopic level, which is kind of entertaining. Mm-hmm. And so he goes to talk to that guy, and that guy reveals who the customer was, which is the mobster, gangster slash club owner guy. And so he goes to question him at the bar, gets sidetracked by having drinks until he sees Zora, and then he goes and does his weird, I'm going to say a feat of voice, where he tries to con her into letting him into the dressing room, which does.
It's like his fake European accent that he uses in, which of those Indiana Jones, where he pretends to be French with the beret?
Oh, no, he's pretending to be Scottish with the beret.
Oh, right, that's Scottish.
It's in Last Crusade.
It's not far from that, and then where he punches the guy.
It's far enough. He goes in there and he's like, hey, I'm going to check your room for holes because nobody should be taking advantage of you. And then she's like, you know, naked, because they hired the actress to do that for this. And she takes her shower, rinsing off all of the scales, changes her hair, puts on the transparent thing, messes him up something good, and then runs away. Because she knows that he is questioning whether or not she should really be there, and where she got that snake, and all this artificial stuff that would link her to Leon. And that's about as interesting as that gets. The whole thing here with all the Zora stuff is just that you get to see a really interesting visual production design, you know, menagerie of things for many shots, and they get to go to many locations. So that's all nice to look at. It really has nothing to really impart to Zora as a character. So blah, whatevs.
She's strong and she runs away and then gets shot, and then we see part of Harrison Ford's, in giant air quotes, humanity, because he's so shaken up by this dead body that he has to go buy a bottle of alcohol. And then
it's really gruesome the way they chose to film that too.
Yeah. And then he gets dragged back over to the scene of the crime by a police chief, who just kind of goes like, hey, good job, look what you did. And he's like, yeah, I know what I did. I was here. What's the deal? And then he's like, yep, four left and three left. And that's when we get the thing that like, oh no, Rachel ran away. You got to go kill her now.
Yay. Mm.
It's very pretty. Like all of this, like the depth, like it's hard to overstate how good the production design and cinematography of this movie is. Like it's cramped and dense, and it looks lived in, and it's beautiful in a very dirty, broken way, and it's perfect for the setting. I just wish there was a better story to go in this setting.
Yeah, I mean, even I will say there are some exceptions to how great the production design and style of this film is. And I would say most notably, that would be in the cigarette smoking, because that never really took off in the way that they were envisioning for cigarette smoking in this time frame. So when you're watching the film nowadays, it seems almost sillier than the CRT monitors that are inside of the film to see so many people lighting up cigarettes.
Mm, I mean, it could come back around. If the world falls into this big of an economic depression, I think it could come back around.
Something tells me these clean indoor air restrictions aren't going away. Not at the Tire Rail Corporation, anyways.
Well, they'll move all those restrictions to the fancy, shiny new off-planet colonies, but once the local environment is so polluted that it literally doesn't matter if you're smoking indoors.
Yeah. Oh, and in the chat room, I just noticed that the hidden Millennium Falcon was brought up. If you look at the, I think it's the top of the police station, the big circular thing that has sort of the wheel shaped top to it. You know that building? The spinner goes at the beginning of the movie.
I'm sure I would remember it if I saw it. No.
Yeah, I believe that's where the Millennium Falcon thing is in there.
Mm. I was just going to say his like kitchen bathroom area and his house kind of looks like the inside of the Millennium Falcon too.
Well, there's also the sort of concrete tiles that you see in his apartment are Frank Lloyd Wright tiles, based off of the concrete textile designs is what Frank Lloyd Wright called them, that he did for I think it was Holly House, might have been, but they were his California houses that he did at the time, where he sort of had these cast blocks that had a pattern to them. So you see those in there. Holly Hawk's house. Sorry. Thank you, TM.
They're very cool. Are they still available for sale? Because I would put them in my office here.
Well, I think you can get some knockoffs. I mean, you know, in The Rocketeer, when Neville Sinclair has his house.
Yes,
that's the Hollyhock house with the same concrete textile design. Although that is, of course, the original, and not the tiny little apartment.
Whoa, this is a weird looking house.
Yeah.
Oh, I like this. This little courtyard looks like it was in an Indiana Jones movie.
Probably, maybe, sure. Why not?
I would shoot so many things here. This is an awesome looking thing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, but you also have your own Frank Lloyd Wright stuff because you have the Biltmore, right?
Yeah. There's also the like 70% underground House of the Future that has no right angles in it. Actually, one of the guys I worked with at Intel lived there for a while.
Huh. Yeah. Well, I didn't see that one. I did go to Taliesin West when we had visited that one time and we went on a tour there. Mm. It was so hot. So hot.
Yeah, I don't think he really planned for air conditioning, did he?
No.
Kind of ruins the lines. You got to put bulkheads and stuff in.
Yeah. I mean, they kind of added it after the fact. It's really interesting to see all these different elements incorporated in here. And I have to say that Douglas Trumbull did some pretty amazing stuff for the era, considering it's all optical. Flares and all kinds of stuff with the intensity of elements, because if you look at stuff of this time period, like Star Wars or another Douglas Trumbull thing, Star Trek: The Motion Picture, you see lots of very bright, pretty surfaces. And this is not a movie full of bright, pretty surfaces. There's just the sort of like dark grunginess. Like there's these really complicated models that fall off into almost nothingness in terms of the level of stuff that you can see. And as you're flying by like the Terrell building, you see all these other little tiny lights moving around too, to give you a sense of scale. And while it's not perfect by any means, especially by modern assessments, I would say that I don't think I could name anything else in the 80s that I would place above this in terms of the execution of what they were doing. Even the little floating blimp things with the electronic displays on the side.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's all neat stuff.
Yeah, it looks good. I mean, it looks a little 80s, but it looks very good.
Yeah, I mean, design-wise, it looks 80s, but, you know, there's just not much you could do. You got an optical printer. It's what you got to work with.
I liked it.
Mm-hmm. But,
I'm looking at all these Frank Lloyd Wright tiles that I can buy for $200 a tile.
You cover up all of the Cocopelli tiles that you have.
Oh, no, I would line the inside of my house with this stuff, make it look like Blade Runner.
What you really need to do come up with, you know, like sound batting that looks like those concrete tiles. So that way you can put it in sound recording booths.
That's actually a really good idea. Nobody steal that idea. That's our idea. We're going to sell sound baffles that look like
sell this thing that looks like somebody else's stuff.
Yeah. That would actually be really cool, even if it was like you just sound padding. I mean, because it would be cheaper and you could stick it on the wall easier than these actual tiles.
Right. Yeah.
And then the next thing you got to do is figure out how to light the interior of house entirely from like chest level lights blasting in through the blinds.
Yeah. Oh, well, there is, of course, that iconic scene where they Harrison Ford says it's too bright in here and Tyrell pushes a button on his desk and the windows have like this sort of shade, like they turn into sort of a sunglass material. It seems to polarize as it goes down. While it's doing that and you cut to the view of them from the other angle where you can't see the window, you see the shadow cross all of them while you see a cyan light coming up at the bottom, at the base of it. At no point in the outside view was there a cyan light. So either he has little accent lights that Tyrell likes to light up, or that's just a little bit of creative license that
they
were taking.
Maybe it was a blimp.
It was a passing blimp. Yeah, just hovered there.
It's kind of it's kind of one of those like concert like LED like spreader lights too, because it's kind of like in a thin like plane of light, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's passing through all of the smoke and fog that's inside of these sets.
It's really cool looking.
Yeah. Well, I think Ridley Scott had something that he burned that he didn't like the way the fog machine smoke looked on set in Alien. So I think he lit either incense or was he like burning oil or something? Anyway, he did something weird because he didn't like the way that the fog machine smoke looked. Mm. So I don't know if he also was trying to pull the same tricks here. This movie is heavy on atmosphere, shall we say, in basically every environment that you come across. Nothing in here feels like a real place that you would go, because nothing is that smoky ever under any conditions, unless you're, I don't know, in Europe somewhere.
I would like to live in this world. That would be cool.
Indoors
in some of the world. The outdoor, I mean, might as well just go live in San Francisco if you like the outdoor of this world.
Well, I would say I would like to live in one of the off-world colonies, except we never saw them, so they might not even exist. They might just ship people up into space and kill them.
Yeah. I mean, clearly they're very far away the population. Since what's-his-name's talking about Orion and stuff.
Yeah, the shoulder of Orion.
Does Orion actually have a shoulder?
Yes. In the metaphorical, like, abstract sense of what Orion is as a constellation, yes.
Well, in the constellation, I thought he just had, like, he's got his belt, he's got his, like, a foot, and then, like, a head.
Nope.
Hmm.
There's more to it. It's meant to be poetic. I don't know if he was really off the shoulder of Orion, if he was just, like, that was just the constellation he was looking at. Or maybe he was just fabricating it. Who knows? I would like to see a movie that's just about Roy and what he was doing in this weird outer space military, because who would they even have been fighting? Like, I don't understand that.
I would also like to understand the mechanism that they used to control the replicants, because he's talking about a lot of things that he did and saw regrettably. And it's like, well, is there like a descent override button that they hit? They're like, no, Roy, you're going to go kill all these people whether you want to or not.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, he's probably just murdering a bunch of rebellious colonists who are like, yay, we're finally free of Earth and we're on the off-world colonies. And they're like, nope. And go crush them.
You got attack ships that are on fire. Like, did they find other... Does this movie confirm that there are other alien species off-world?
No. It doesn't at any point do that. So I would assume that this is mainly humans fighting other humans. or at least replicants fighting other humans. But
they're staking their claim on planets, and then the government comes in and they're like, oh, no, this is part of ours now. And they're like, no, we're going to fight you.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Send in Roy. Go kill them all.
But, you know, there is a rich world to be mined, have been mined. I don't know. Like we said at the start of this, neither one of us has seen the sequel picture that has come out and has flopped at the box office. But
oh, no. Well, at least it's keeping the tradition going.
We also didn't mention, like you had just alluded to right in this very moment, that the first was not an entirely successful financial endeavor. It was not looked upon favorably. Like Alan Ladd, who had used basically, I think, this date or something around this date for Star Wars and for Alien when he was at 20th Century Fox, and then when he went to Warner Brothers, he was doing Blade Runner, he picked this or something. Anyway, he was like, yay, this will be great. And then this movie did not do well at all. The studio had heavily manufactured things to be a certain way. It wasn't reviewed all that well. It's mainly looked upon fondly in hindsight from that point. I would say that there is a cult following that blossomed, and now it's revered.
You know how they say there's like a comedian's comedian? Like, this is a filmmaker's movie.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's a very filmy movie. I mean, this is for people that are up their own butt about being auteurs. It's all like, oh, look how artsy it is. And it's like, yay, it is. I mean, there's some teachable moments in here for making your films.
I guess the other part that angers me, and again, this is all through my particular perspective and lens about how I divide up roles and things on set and how I direct things. Like, when I look at this movie, yes, of course, the director is in charge of all of this, but when you talk about production design, cinematography, all of the other aspects of this movie, when I try and look at, aside from the fact that, again, yes, Ridley Scott was technically in charge of all of it, what did he do versus what some of the other people on this movie did? And I feel like his contribution is less than that of the cinematographer, the production design people.
I would agree with you. I mean, he picks these people based on their previous works, like the film score for this, Vangelis. He picked Vangelis based on the Oscar-winning score he did for Chariots of Fire. So he picks people based on the work that he sees and cultivates what the movie is going to wind up being based on that. He had approached Mobius to do the production design stuff, but Mobius declined to do some other animated French thing. I don't know. I forget. And he regretted doing that later on, because the guys who did actually go on to do the production design did a good job. I think, is certainly looked upon favorably from that side of things. And while I'm sure that Ridley Scott had lots of edicts about like how he wanted things to be, like film noir, and he wanted a lived-in look, and he wanted a blending of eras, he didn't draw any of the things literally. He did sketch some things, but he didn't like make what you see on screen. But no director like really does get their hands that dirty doing it, because they should really be busy doing other stuff,
plot and character things.
And Douglas Trumbull, like, he's just somebody you can point at a problem and give him some like parameters, and then you'll have a bunch of pretty stuff. Like, I don't think I can think of anything bad to say about Douglas Trumbull's work on any previous endeavor, but yeah, he certainly is one way to make sure that your film is favorably received, is to trust your visual effects team to do to deliver for you.
Mm.
And of course, it doesn't hurt if you hire Sid Mead, so do that too.
Sid's always good. And I guess while I'm being sacrilege and talking bad about Ridley Scott in this movie, I'll throw one other thing at you that you may object to just based on your personal preferences. I would love a version of this movie that strips out all of the saxophone score and puts something in like a modern Trent Reznor kind of score.
that might be interesting. And I don't know, you might need to, we might need to see the sequel and find out what happens with that.
Yeah,
for scoring.
Point.
Yeah.
Just because, like, in terms of the visuals being modern and futuristic, nothing says the 80s like echoey saxophone.
Well, or the synth that was going on in there, too. Things playing off of one another.
TM says, why not Daft Punk? Daft Punk is too fancy and upbeat. Trent Reznor is the one who can make you, like, sad and uncomfortable with his, like, electronic stuff.
Daft Punk can make some moody stuff, too.
Mm-hmm. But, I mean, Trent Reznor is very good at making you feel bad about things. And I think this movie is trying to make you feel bad about certain things.
Yeah, well, I mean, not everything's The Social Network, Dan.
Yeah, that's what I'm getting back to is this movie should be more like The
Social
Network.
Watch another movie, Dan.
No. Blade Runner's not as good as The Social Network.
This is your new metric for everything. Well, as good as The Social Network?
Yes or no? That's not even apples and oranges. That's like apples and flip-flops.
Okay.
Oh, God, flip-flops is a Social Network reference. I didn't even mean to do that.
Was it?
Because he wears the flip-flops.
Oh, I forgot Mark Zuckerberg invented flip-flops and...
No, but that was his thing.
Inspired the movie.
It was one of his defining characteristics.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's why I think about it so much. But I will say there's one thing in here that if you were making this film for a modern audience, you certainly would cut out of here. And it's curious that in the final cut, which was made in the late 2000s, that Ridley Scott did not revisit his decision to do this. But there is the scene between Rachel and Harrison Ford, which I always forget about, presumably because I block it out of my memory. But I watch the two of them, and when she tries to leave the apartment, and he restrains her and forces her against the blinds.
Yeah, nothing is more like dumb macho 80s love scene than like the way he like puts the side of his fist against the door to shut it, like, no, you're not leaving yet.
Yeah, that is not good. How can I put this? I don't think Ridley Scott knew that was bad at the time. But he should have known, and he also should know now, and he should have known when he did the final cut. And, like, I don't know why this hasn't really been revisited, he forces himself on her. She does agree, but it's seemingly under duress and not like a situation where she's playing coy.
Yeah, no, it's the subtext of the scene is, calm down, woman, you're being hysterical. If you were being rational right now, you would realize that you love me and I love you.
Yeah, I don't care for that.
No, it's not good, but there's really no way to cut around that and then still make their vague love story make any sense. Like, the fact that she stays in the house and they run off together at the end, like, would work even less, I should say, if that scene didn't happen. But it's still, yes, it's a very bad scene.
That should just be redone in some way. Like, if they ever rebooted this movie, not that they're going to do that now, but if they ever did that...
Let's say if Blade Runner 2049 has a date rape scene in it, we'll know that there's something very, very bad about it.
Yeah. Especially when you look at the news... in this day and age about, let's just say, certain high-powered Hollywood executive moguls who take advantage of the power that they have over other people to make them do things that they would not ordinarily feel compelled to do. I don't feel like that is the kind of thing I would like to see in movies. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Also, gross. I mean, just in terms of, like, yeah, being wrong and gross is one thing, but, like, it's completely... out of character for Deckard too. Like, it makes no sense for him.
Yeah, no, because he was repulsed by her in a way, but felt pity for her.
He was kind of scared.
But then all of a sudden
he was scared and then drunk and then he passed out and then he woke up and then suddenly he was like, oh, you played piano beautifully and like, don't feel bad that they're not your memories. I'm going to console you by kissing your face. And she's like, what are you doing here?
Yeah.
And she's clearly, like, vulnerable in the state of, like, I'm just coming to terms with the fact that I'm a robot right now. Can you not? Yeah. And that,
I would say she's in shock, basically.
Yeah. And the solution to that is let's do it, apparently, because I'm a sad, drunken, broken human being whose job I have no choice but to kill replicants because the police chief said I have no choice and I have to do it. And you're a robot, so life is bad for both of us. So let's just be miserable together and we're dating now.
Yay.
It doesn't fit. Like, if he was really that emotionally scarred or broken by what he's doing, he would just like curl up in a ball and pull the blanket over his head and just like go to sleep.
Yeah, they didn't necessarily need to have these characters fall in love, but if they were to pursue that, I would have preferred something that more closely resembled the emotions and feelings that they were supposedly having to this.
I got a perfect retcon for it. So he is an alcoholic and he's sad and he's emotionally traumatized by the fact that he ostensibly kills human-looking things all day long. And for him, there's no difference between replicants and humans because they look like humans, they act like humans, they die like humans, and he is the one that has to kill them because the law says so. But here comes along Nexus 7 Rachel. Not only does she not know she's a replicant, she lives like the entire lifespan of a regular human being, say. So there is basically no difference between her and humans anymore. And he is now in a moral quandary where he's like, guys, this is not right to just kill these people because they're like, yes, they're replicants, but they're basically humans. They have human emotions. They feel things, you know. It's not right to kill her. So he's protective of her in that sense and not in a I love you because you're going to die sense. And then he uses that as a reason that they need to stick together, not because he just feels like having a robot that he can sleep with.
Yeah.
That works better in my brain.
I agree. Just having an emotional connection instead of I'm going to shut this door and push you against the blinds and then ta-da, we're together. It's bad. Enough of that. I think we've aired our grievances, and also embraced all of the things that we really like about the film. Are there any final closing thoughts that you have, as a Blade Runner owner, that you want to share?
The blades have run. I look forward to seeing 2049 at some point because it's got Ryan Gosling in it, so it can't be all bad. It's got Harrison Ford in a t-shirt for some reason.
I get the feeling that Harrison Ford's wardrobe was mostly dictated by what he felt like putting on, and not maybe so much what the filmmakers wanted, because it just seems silly, especially when you're looking at the promotional photos and it's just like, wait, you just showed up on set in that? Like, did you roll out of your car in that?
I guess before we actually see 2049, I don't know if we're going to do this soon or whatever or at all. You know, we talked about it flopping at the box office. I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that not everyone is super familiar with this movie, the original Blade Runner. But also, I don't know if you've been watching the trailers or if you're full media blackout on Blade Runner 2049, but the trailers don't really give you any reason that you should go see this movie. Like, they're very vague and kind of mysterious, as they should be. Hopefully not because the movie is bad, hopefully just because they're trying to be vague and mysterious, but they don't really give you any reason to go see the movie.
I'm not in full media blackout for the film. I'm not reading articles about behind the scenes things or any of that stuff, but I have watched the trailers and the commercials and stuff. The commercials and the trailers, for the most part, seem to play up the visual aspects of it, which look good, because with the talent involved, I would have no reason to believe they would look anything other than good. But there is no real clear draw to it other than, do you want to see pretty pictures and Ryan Gosling and Harrison Ford? Then there you go. And if anything, you know, people might be seeing Jared Leto and going, oh, no, I learned my lesson, Jared Leto. no more blockbusters with you in it.
I mean, the other thing about, and we shouldn't read too much into trailers, like, you see one scene that includes Jared Leto in this trailer. So I predict he has a pretty small role in the movie.
We're making predictions now?
No, I don't want to predict. Cause
you did. You said you were making a prediction.
I already have a list of predictions that I hope are not true.
Yeah, I don't know. I have no predictions for this. I don't want to know the narrative reasons for seeing this, but I would agree that from the marketing, it would be difficult to use these materials to get in a standard movie-going audience. And if anything, this kind of confirms why so many trailers give away literally everything.
It kind of feels like the trailers for Oblivion, where they don't want to give away the trick, so they just, like, it's, oh, look, it's a future movie with that person you know.
Yeah, and that is also a concern, is that there's going to be one trick that is just going to be, like, you know, ta-da!
It's not a one-trick pony, it's a one-trick unicorn.
Oh, man. That was a good one. It's a really good one.
Thank you. I'm bringing it, like, bringing it back around to unicorns.
Not to toot your own unicorn, but that was nice. Let's go ahead and wrap this one up. Commence wrapping. Enhance wrapping.
Wrap it enhance. In tinfoil shaped, like, what were the other things he made? He made a unicorn. He made like a duck or something. I don't remember what the other ones were.
I'll be perfectly honest, and that I could not tell what all of them were. I thought one of them might have been a swan.
Yeah, one of them kind of looked like a giraffe or something, too, because it had a very long neck.
Could have been.
Yeah. It wasn't even, like, using his own gum wrappers. He was just finding, like, trash everywhere.
Well, did you look around, Dan? Reduce, reuse, recycle.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. TM says there is foil origami. I can do a fair amount of origami. I learned a lot of that stuff when I was younger.
Okay.
I can make the little swans that flap and the swans that don't flap. I remember I made a panda one time, too.
You're so talented.
No, it wasn't me. It was my exchange student friend who taught me all of it.
But wait, you could still do it, right? You weren't just, like, handing it off to him as an outsourcing maneuver.
He would do it, and I would watch him, and we would do it side by side. It was cool.
Oh, okay. So, see, you are talented, then, if you can do it.
I don't remember all of them now. Like, he made a tank one time that I thought was pretty cool. Mostly, I just remember how to do the swan.
Well, it's good.
I liked the non-canonical swan where you pull in the tail and the wings flap, and I always liked that one instead of the one where the wings were super flat and symmetrical.
Okay.
Origami.
Let's fold this podcast up.
I think we already did.
Crease it.